You're listening to Confessing Animals with Jen Harris and Vanessa Arrico, rebel poets, real rebels, really talking poets, rebelling and listening.
Okay, don't interrupt me.
Hey, everybody. Welcome to another episode of Confessing Animals podcast. I am your host, Jen Harris.
And I am your other host, Vanessa Arrico.
There we are. All right. So today we are speaking with Calvin Arsenia. Calvin Arsenia has built a reputation for turning the arts world on its head, voted Kansas City's best musician 2018 to present by the Pitch KC, and featured on Billboard, NPR, Do you know how to say that?
New Now Next.
I can't read there we go. One word. Pride.com and Grammy.com. Arsenia's angelic stylings on voice and harp create rare harmonies and arrangements that look past the boundaries of his traditional gospel and classical upbringing. Known for his elaborate and ceremonious sensory concert experiences that merge jazz and electronic influences, Calvin consistently delivers genre-bending and gender-bending shows that tackle sexuality, religion, and race in a stunning, unorthodox manner, somewhere between sacred and sacrilege. A healthy serving of indie rock, neo-soul, R&B, and a splash of art pop, this multi-instrumentalist singer-songwriter is a shimmering force to be reckoned with.
Yes, he is.
What a bio. I'm so excited. Good job, Calvin and company, for getting that bio in order. Delicious.
And two of my favorite things, music, poetry, songwriting, sacred and sacrilege, revenge and redemption. I mean, come on.
We're gonna get into it. I've known Calvin for a long time. This evolution has been really extraordinary, and I'm super excited for you all to listen in and hear all about Calvin's journey with redemption. You ready to get started?
Let's do it.
Well, welcome to the show. So glad you could join us live from Iowa. What the fuck are you doing in Iowa?
It's actually pretty cool. I've got a gig here with Quixotic. And so we're playing at their Performing Arts Center. And it's like an outdoor experience. So there's like different vignettes that's set up around there. A really nice and pretty new performing arts center here in Iowa City. I thought I was going to Davenport. Both of those things are things I don't know anything about. So I just woke up early yesterday morning, put the name of the venue in my GPS and started driving. And
there
that's
you are.
Typically how it happens. And then once I got closer, I realized I was supposed to meet everybody at the hotel. So then I found the other address to put that in the GPS, and then I parked my car and here I am.
Well, thank you for taking time out to talk with us this morning.
Oh, this is a great way to spend the morning. So,
well, welcome to it. So we are so excited to have you on Confessing Animals. I read your bio in our intro and was like, okay, rub it in though.
Oh, by the way, hi, Calvin. I'm Vanessa.
Hi. Nice to meet you, Vanessa.
Nice to meet you.
I forget that not everybody knows you as intimately as I do. So it's good to see you, my dear. First of all, every good boy does fine. Now out, Simon & Schuster has it on their website. How are you feeling?
It's pre-orders available. It comes out on September 21st, officially.
Oh, okay. Fantastic. Well,
at least it's supposed to. I don't know who Simon & Schuster is, but if they're releasing my book early, I want a copy.
My favorite part of this sentence is, I don't know who Simon & Schuster is. If there's any fuck you to the gatekeepers, that's it. That's like saying, I don't know who Britney Spears is.
Wait, who's that? I'm just kidding.
Who?
Well, we were actually just talking about you before you got here, about your covers, and you know, your well-known Britney Spears Toxic cover. Yeah. Like, and I know we're just kind of jumping in, but I'm just curious about, like, does that song take on different meaning for you, like when you're singing it? Or is it just kind of like a tribute and like, I'm just doing a cover song, right? Or does Toxic mean something different to you?
Well, I would never just do a cover just for a cover's sake, because my singing is sacred. And if we're going to jump in,
welcome to it.
Like, right. I mean, what I wanted to say just then, but then I edited myself. And so I'm going to go back and not edit myself. But what I want to say to you is that my mouth is sacred and the things that come out of it mean something to me. And so Toxic, like, I've definitely been in, like, you can apply that to like romantic relationships where I've been, where somebody has definitely taxed me by just existing and taken a toll out of my life force. But then I think about the video and how I wanted to portray the video and have it not be speaking about a romantic relationship. And a little bit of that was because I still wanted to be a little bit ambiguous. I mean, yeah, it didn't work, but I didn't want it to be like this, like very like homoerotic thing necessarily. And I definitely didn't want to do it with a woman in that video. So the concept was about music and my need to create and like the fact that I have to deal with like even the smallest sliver of the music industry in order to be able to be a part of the music. To be a musician, and so like so Toxic has taken on this meaning of like I hate the game around having to like perform or having to be in the music industry, be in social media, do all these things just so that I could be intimate with music, and so that's taken on a lot of meanings, if that answers your question.
Would you dare suggest there's a lot of toxicity then in the experience that you're having in a bigger industry? Or is it, I mean, has the game changed and it's just always been this way?
I think it's always been this way and it just manifests in different ways. I mean, like popularity contest parts of it, like, and in some ways, wow, we're just going to go right in. So, I mean, back in the day, they would like, I don't know, we've seen all the documentaries. The labels and stuff would own the music, and then they would just and then artists would get nothing, and then you kind of now it's like unless you've got a million TikTok subscribers, like people won't even bat a lash at you, and you know your connection to your instruments, your connection to your voice, your vulnerability, your those things tend to be kind of by the wayside because they're not profitable. and so this idea of profitability in the music industry. And like immediate viability as far as turning sales over and that each person who is an artist has to think of themselves more of as a whole store, a whole brand rather than just because music is free these days, right? You got Spotify, you pay for $10 a month and you have access to literally everything. And I mean, not literally, but almost everything. And so there's no money in actually making recordings. And so you have to, if you want the attention of somebody who's going to help you get on stages and be able to present your work, you have to do it like all the, I don't know. There's so much around trying to make a career out of this work that is very toxic. And, but at the same time, I'm obsessed with music and I'm obsessed with connecting with my audiences in real and transformative ways. And I'm obsessed with, sharing my story because I've always felt growing up that my story was too taboo and that my truth was an illegal substance and learning that it isn't and learning that my truth and my story is actually beautiful and that my love is beautiful means to me that it's my duty to go out and share it. And so I will endure the toxicity of the industry in order to make sure that I'm doing what I was sent to this earth to do.
Oh my gosh. I think that's a perfect segue. We can backtrack a little bit. You know, you mentioned kind of your background and growing up, and you have a podcast, like We Were Christian Kids. And I listened to your latest episode, your 33rd episode. You guys announced a hiatus. But why don't you kind of take us through the impetus for this podcast and kind of give us a little bit of your background?
Sure. So the podcast started last fall. Myself and my best friend, Justin Randall, who is a comedian in New York, we used to run Bible studies together in a little town called Olathe, Kansas. And we were really intense about it, though. I went to church probably 6 or 7 times a week, different services. And most of those services, I was playing music for them. So I was a worship leader in high school. And then I became a missionary after high school. I was involved in lots of different ministries, more conservative ministries, very charismatic ministries, being that like people who lay on of hands, speaking of tongues, laying out in the spirit. Are we getting laid out in the spirit? So people passing out, overwhelmed with the presence of God. I was a missionary in Scotland, so I moved there and worked for a church for 2 years. And in that process, actually, so I was 22 when I moved there. And that journey was a really good but also very intense one. And in that process of being a missionary, I decided that I didn't want to be a part of the church anymore. And came back to Kansas City, but also realizing that I had to be an artist, and I knew that this was my calling, and that so many people don't know what their calling is. And so if I have the honor of the universe to be told or to be let know, to be privy of this information, that I should just do it. And that if I do what this is funny because I'm right now in the process of trying to like rework some of my vernacular, because like I said, I want to do what I was sent here to do, but I don't really believe I was sent here anymore. This is something that I have always said. But I do believe that this is the way that I can best engage with the world as it is. And so it feels as though I've been sent here to do this, to be a musician and to tell stories. But then I've, you know, being in Kansas City as an artist, even I have felt the pressure to remain neutral on subjects that have been historically taboo. And it wasn't until the beginning of this podcast that I was actually saying in literal words, like, the church hurt me. The church hurts lots of people. The church should probably take a back seat and just chill the fuck out. And at the very least, if it still wants to engage and continue the work of Jesus, who I believe actually is an incredible, story. It's a beautiful myth. And if it isn't true, it's still a beautiful myth. And that if they want to continue the work of, you know, being a radical people who help poor, who help sex workers, who help dismantle oppressive systems, then they should just do that. and they should be also like trained. You should be trained in religious trauma before you're ever allowed to talk to people. And so this is kind of something that through the process of the podcast that I feel like is kind of my cry for justice is like, if you're going to be a minister, then you need to understand the ramifications of when you do your job poorly. And because they are also eternal, just like when you do your job well. And so we as this summer kind of like got ramped up and events were more available to artists and audiences, just some performance that he's doing as a stand-up comedian and that I've been doing as a musician. And we want to come back in the fall, like with a little bit more of a strategy maybe, because we started it like in, you know, last year, last fall, when there was really nothing happening. And we had this like theory that maybe there are other people that were having conversations like us that about, you know, growing up being very like vigilant Christians, self-hating homosexuals, and that we didn't really see conversations that were specifically talking about, you know, undoing and unwinding that process. And that, you know, if we did put the conversations out there, then we might be able to find a community of these people and other people to really find solace in. And that theory, turns out there's lots of us.
You have really hit the nail on the head in a roundabout way. In that season three for Confessing Animals, the theme is revenge and redemption. And we ask folks to really to pick one, right? And the conversations so far have been, holy shit, they're so intertwined and so much more complex and nuanced than we ever approached the subjects with. But I, you know, it's so specific to what you're talking about in that I know we both come from very religious Christian backgrounds, and we both kind of came out as artists and queers, and we're like, what now? So the subject of redemption feels complicated, because I feel like our source, our origin of understanding that ideology is from the church. So I'm wondering, do you feel like there was a redemption process in creating this podcast? Is there some sort of kind of coming back to yourself or some sort of awareness that you have now that you didn't have before?
Yeah. And like you're saying, that's such, it is like so intertwined and messy and beautiful. Because it feels like both. And I don't know if you have like gotten there yet. Like how revenge and redemption can actually be the same, one and the same. Mm-hmm. Because in some ways it feels like revenge on both my younger self, which this is something that's been really crazy. I had a realization maybe about a month or two ago that I'm currently living my childhood worst nightmare. I am in a like long-term loving relationship with a man. I wear dangly earrings. I paint my nails.
You're sabotaging everything you told yourself you would be.
Exactly. And I can remember sitting around as a 12-year-old, you know, lost in thought, and be like, you know, like, who do I want to be when I grow up? And I've always been kind of a futurist thinker like that. And you know, just imagining myself I always thought, and I'll share a poem later, but about this specific thing. But like, you know, I'm literally the epitome of everything I hated and didn't want to be, and so there's a little bit of like a tinge of revenge to be able to be like, no, little Calvin, like this is actually okay. Like you can be all the things that you like, and you can do all the things that you're drawn to, and that you don't have to be afraid. But in the same sense, it's redeeming. It's redeeming, you know, all of the, like, you know, just my soft side sorry, I feel like I don't remember the question now.
No, but I kind of wanted to jump in really quick, because I'm really glad that you brought up like this idea of kind of like revenge on your younger self, almost like, no, you were wrong. But like, I think as your style has evolved, right? Like how important are the aesthetics for like, is there redemption in your style now is more self-expression? You said, you know, with the earrings, with the nails, with the, you know, how you present yourself now, as a performer, as a person, as a, you know, fully embodied, you know, queer, or however you envision yourself, you know what I mean? Like how does style fit into this redemption process?
Well, there's definitely some practical, elements here. So I paint my nails because when I'm playing the harp, this is the thing that's moving. And I'm not a dancer, and I'm not, you know, parading around the stage normally. And also the clothes, the garments that I wear when I perform, and I'm always performing. A friend of mine, Justin Wilson, a few years ago, he was mentoring me through a few different things when I was recording my first full-length record, Catastrophe, which is not available anywhere right now. But I was like really struggling, because I was like, I want I want the theater to be happening everywhere I am. And this comes from the fact that, like, as an acoustic singer-songwriter earlier in my career, I kept getting booked to play coffee shops and stuff like that. And I would you know, be building these sets of music and really wanting to share significant portions of my life, but also fighting people trying to order their skinny latte in the espresso machine. And so I had to, like, come up with a plan and a strategy to, like, how can I never play a coffee shop again?
Oh, so, haven't we all been there? Oh, is that a bus stop being thrown down in the middle of my set? Fucking cool.
And so the plan was, I have to put on this fucking massive show, cover it with glitter and roses and shapes and size, you know, all these, you know, things, so that when people think of me, thinking of putting me in their coffee shop sounds like a mess and a hassle, and that they would never do it again. And and Jen, you were at Catastrophe, so you can attest to that. Any coffee shop owner that might have been in the room that night would never have invited me.
Beautiful, beautiful mess release, dance, sweaty, gorgeous, insane party I've ever been to. Hands down, my favorite album release I've ever attended. So yes. No, don't put that shit in a coffee shop. Do not do it.
This is like the perfect, like, self-defense mechanism, but it's like, it's a strategy to, like, not be invited to places you don't fucking want to be. Be, right? Like, yes. Make yourself unappealing for the places you don't want to be.
Yeah, exactly. And dress for the job you want. And so
you know, I love that, so your flair is part of, like, the I can't work in any less environment.
Yes, it is. But okay, but then after that, I was talking to Justin Wilson, and he kind of gave me this idea. He's like, well, if you can't build a set everywhere you go, then be the set. And so, like, I am in charge of what garments I wear with my body. And even though I might not be able to dress every single venue that I go to, like that album release show, I can at least bring a part of that set with me on my frame, and I don't need extra hands to do it. So there were those two, those practical elements of the gold paint on the nails, so that you can see something moving on the stage, and what I dress in is a part of, like, you know, dressing for the job I want, and holding that after a few years of living in Scotland and also coming back and watching different musicians and singer-songwriters present their work, I realized that it wasn't the quality of the musician, it wasn't the quality of the technical skills of a musician that made their work impactful to audiences. It was how the music was presented, and it was the value that the artist put on their work that taught the audience how to value their work. And so I decided that I was going to teach my audience how to value my work by valuing my work myself, by presenting myself in a way, by presenting my work on a golden platter rather than a paper plate, because I had seen both of those things be true. And you can present the exact same work on two different plates. You can present the exact same meal on two different plates. And the perception, the honor at which that those people come to the table, is entirely different. And but it can be the exact same music, it can be the exact same food, it can be the exact same poems, it can be the exact same theater. But it's the frame that teaches the audience how to perceive it. And so those things kind of, you know, happen on the stage. And up until, you know, March of 2020, I had been on the stage every week since I was 12. The stage raised me. And so I don't really see myself apart from that, because that isn't true. My life has been on stage. But at the same sense, you know, some of the stuff that I do with, like, gender play on stage has allowed me to really work out some things in real life, or like in offstage life as well. And I think on stage, the costume changes and things were about like, will if you accept me in a more like male typical outfit, and while I'm singing these vulnerable songs, will you also accept me in a more gender bending female aesthetic as well? And so, and I love to do costume changes on stage and then like undress on stage and put something else on. And it's like, no, I'm still singing about my truth. I'm still singing about things that happened to me. I'm still singing about my life. And it's always very funny to me when people who are like, you know, middle-aged cis white men who are like, you know, married and retired or whatever. And they're like, wow, like that was really beautiful. I didn't, you know, we probably can't relate on anything, but that was really beautiful. And I'm like, no, we are the same. Like I know you think that we're different, but we're actually just the same. And I said, you know, and I've said, have you ever been in love? Well, this is the thing we have in common. Have you ever had heartbreak? This is the thing we have in common. And I think what I'm trying to do with my work, is to say that every excuse that people have to other people who are like me, is unacceptable. That we are not other, that until my problems are your problems, that then we really have nothing to talk about. So some of those things, I think I'm still in the process and journey of. I mean, I can't say that I have arrived at any of these places totally. I'm still walking, and so maybe I push myself and wear things that I'm secretly drawn to, but I wear them publicly because I want my childhood self to know that I am safe and that I am able to live authentically. You know, whereas I could be more conservative if I wanted to be, you know, but like, I want to challenge myself to not present a diminished version of myself because of fear or because I don't want, you know, I don't know. It's about representation. And I think I'm showing up for myself in this way more than I am everybody else.
When you're reparenting yourself to some degree, right? You're loving that inner child and soothing all of his like quiet anxieties and any sort of defensiveness that he might experience from the environment, which has raised him with a certain type of beliefs. So Vanessa made this really interesting connection earlier about you play the harp, and the harp is so denoted as an angelic instrument. And I'm curious because now we've got, you know, it is all a messy, muddled journey of like, I assume, and correct me if I'm wrong, that you don't identify as a Christian anymore, but also you're deeply intertwined with this, like, oh, at heaven's gate, there will be a harp. And there's all this beautiful history about harps and their connection to divination and earliest harps being found in ancient Sumer in 3500 BCE and being excavated from burial pits and royal tombs. Like, how did this instrument wind up in your life and you're continuing to utilize it? You know, I don't want to say in spite of this transition, but just, I mean, it has a lot of connections. It has a lot of connotations. So how did you get to the harp and like, what does it mean to you?
Wow. It's a lot.
Right. It sure is.
Oh, there's a lot there. There's so much there. I mean, the is the earliest known stringed instrument. The only earlier instruments known to man are drums. And I touched a harp for the first time when I was 20 years old. And that was the beginning of some kind of deconstructing, fuck the patriarchy. I had the first time I saw a harp, I was 4 years old. And I think even at that time, I knew and could feel this feeling of gatekeeping. This idea of, you know, you could never, that it's always been a very feminine instrument. And like you said, angelic. But I think I remember being a young person, like in high school or whatever, and just feeling like I could never do that because people would know that I was gay if I played the harp. And And then I kind of got over it because people thought I was weird and feminine anyway. And so at 20 years old, I rented a harp for the first time from a harp studio in Lenexa, Kansas. And for $60 a month, I could take, you know, do YouTube tutorials and study that way because I couldn't afford lessons at the time. So I just did YouTube for the first year, and then I moved to Scotland after that and took lessons from the principal harpist of the Scottish Orchestra, Chamber Orchestra, which I found her on their equivalent of Craigslist. And
I like that you were on Craigslist in Scotland. This is wonderful. Yeah.
Wait, what drew you to Scotland? Was it specifically to learn with this teacher or?
No. So this was when I was a missionary, and it was an opportunity that came up because of the Edinburgh Fringe Festival. So I was...
Wait, do Scottish people not know about God? What do you mission? What's a missionary like? What's the... I'm outside of the church. Like, you have to talk to me as if I'm an alien, and I know nothing about this.
For sure. So a missionary to a Christian is more than a position. It is a role that somebody from another land goes into a community to spread the gospel of Jesus. Scotland at the time and still is considered a post-Christian nation. I think people are over it. And it was something that I was excited about because it was like people, I mean, at least this is how it was pitched to me. It's that like Edinburgh was such a cultural hub because of the Fringe Festival, and there's people from all over the world who come there for the Fringe, and it's like very underground, grassroots. And so I was there to bring the kingdom of God to people who had all of their felt needs kind of taken care of. They had water, they had food, they had shelter, but depression is really rampant there. They don't have a lot of sunlight throughout the year. And they typically are pretty self-hating culture. And so I was brought in there, and my mission there was to just bring light and to bring color, to bring life, to encourage people to listen to their dreams and to help facilitate anything that I could. And the church that I was a part of at the time was not very like evangelical in the sense that they wanted us to go out and bring people back to our church community. Our gatherings on Sundays were very small. And I think it was in this undoing of that, this campaigning of trying to like grow a local church in that role as a missionary in Scotland that really started my dismantling of what I knew as the church. So what Americans thought I was doing was probably like standing on the street corner preaching. What Scottish people asked me to do was to go to open mic nights, to perform, to hang out with people, to get to know them, to share my story and for them to share theirs with me and see what happens after that. And that's what I did. And I realized that I was under the impression that, that my best, witness of God, which means like my best testimony or my best, the way that I could prove that God was working in the world was by being perfect myself and by being redeemed and by being a shining example of what God can do in someone's life. But if I was to tell my actual story, I would say that I was being torn apart and tormented by the shame of not being perfect, of not being fully redeemed, of not being the perfect example of what God can do in someone's life. And so I began to share that story about a year and a half in of my 2 years there with these people who were unchurched, and they held me and they held space for me. And I was like, wait, you mean there are people on the planet who will just accept me as I actually really am? Like, I don't have to gaslight myself all the time saying that God is good and like my faith has made me well and all these, you know, all this shit. And so I began to leave the church at that time. But I kind of want to, I don't know. I feel like I didn't go into all the harp things, but
But that's, I mean, that's so that's that is what you were doing there. That's the foundational basis of your experience. And when did you start taking harp lessons? Like, was it post open mic? Like, you were inspired to pursue that, or was it pretty quickly after you got there?
Well, so I mean, within 2 weeks, because I had been playing at home, within 2 weeks of arriving in Scotland, I was like, I can't live without it. I need the harp. And the people who inspired me to play was Joanna Newsom and Bjork and Florence the Machine. At the time, Florence was touring in America with a harpist, and that was like the band was her and a harp. And I was like, I want a harp to play with me. And so I went around Kansas City looking for a harpist before I moved to Scotland, and I was like, you know, I need a young person who will do it for free, who will show up and already know the stuff and like be able to just like jam and write their own parts and, you know, and we go and do it for free. And and I couldn't find that person. So I decided.
So you had to be the young free worker.
Yeah. Exactly.
Emphasis on no budget DIY.
And there's like so much like the socio-political, socio-economical side of harp. I mean, they're just really expensive instruments, and you have to have so there's so many like pre-existing conditions that need to be like set in order to be able to have that in your life and to be able to have access to it.
Yeah, it seems like a little bit of like an elitist instrument, yes. Right? Like it's not you don't see a lot of you know. Harp buskers.
There's no right. $60 harp at Walmart, you know.
No. Entry level is still pretty high level. So I feel like in some ways, you know, I've taken it on to be my you know, to take my harps and my instruments to bars and to places where it's never been before, to be that liaison to say like, you know, however you want to elevate yourself, you have permission to do so. And you know, I do that, and which, you know, carries into all the crowns and all the jewelry and all these things. I don't want people to get the impression, and I don't think that the majority of people do, but you know, maybe they're not the people who are reaching out to me, but I really want to push the message of like, yes, I'm a Black gay kid from Olathe, Kansas, but this is how I've chosen to present and elevate myself. And because this feels good to me, and not to say that you know that anybody else, you know, shouldn't also feel good, because there's some of this stuff in like hip hop culture where it's like I'm the best, so that everyone else sucks. Like, this is not what I'm doing here. It's like, I'm wearing a crown. Here's some more. Do you want to wear one? You know, wear what you want. And I hope that people feel that sense with both, you know, how I presented myself visually, but also with music. It's like, I was 20 years old the first time I touched a harp, and I rented it, you know, with the money that I got from my office job. And I just started learning. Every person out there probably would assume that I started playing when I was a child, that I come from money, that I grew up in a middle class home, but that was, you know, my mom was always cutting coupons, you know, like and saving money wherever she could, I'm staying in like a motel right now, it was provided by the gig, but like I work really hard, and I've worked really hard, and it's like, I didn't come from a trust fund. I didn't like just get handed the situation. It wasn't my mom that like asked me to play the harp. Like, I went out of my way as an awkward 20-year-old and started learning this instrument because it was what I wanted my life to be. And
this seems to me like if there's any like the work of God, like, to me, like, when you started the process of like the unchurching, like, this is where the divine is happening. This is where the work is like really showing up, right? Like, you grabbing the harp, you like telling this honest story and not a self-hating story. And like, this is where like all the real work, like, if I'm going to believe in something divine and godly and beautiful, I mean, all you have to do is open your mouth. I mean, anybody, like, I mean, this conversation is incredible, but like, the minute anyone hears your singing voice, there is just no denying. I don't think there's a separation from like the sacredness that you spoke of. Like, I don't just choose a cover, you know, like the words that come out of my mouth are important, right? Like, there is a sacred connection with the voice that you have, right? Like, whether you want to call it God or universe or Mother Nature, like whatever words, however you want to paint it, you know what I mean? Because I think in the end, we're all searching for the same thing and we put different frameworks around it, right? Like, I think of the theatrics of the church, you know, of the speaking in the tongues, like you still have like this great history of theater and performance and all this stuff. And now you're just interpreting it in a way that makes more sense to you. And you're not telling somebody else's like oppressive story.
Right. Yeah, absolutely. And as I've explored, and even over the course of the, you know, both writing the book and the podcast, you know, I think earlier last year, I would have more seen myself and identified as agnostic. And today I feel way more atheist. Obviously I want to be, or maybe not obviously, but I always want to be teachable and learn and like, and if God wanted to come out and like, you know, out of the clouds and say, hey, I'm actually real. Like, I'd be like, okay. But as it stands right now, I feel like the world is way more fascinating and beautiful to see all these things happening as a product of chance. and that our connection, that miracles, that phenomena are actually a byproduct of this strange and beautiful existence, that things that we call supernatural are actually just very natural, that we do have spiritual connection, that we don't have language or science to study yet, but I think that at some point we will. And, or at least that science will become more common knowledge. I believe that, that we are connected and that there is something, and that the things that we call divine are like fundamental in our existence as people.
Like to the degree of like intuition is an innate human quality and not divine intervention on your experience.
Exactly. There is not somebody like deciding what information I get to be privy on. Like there's not a being like out there, like, you know, doing like having a vision of like the telephone operators, like from like the, I don't know, 50s or something.
Plugging the cables in.
Right. Like
making the connections for you. But it's like all elemental, you know, like the divine or the mystical, like instead of seeing that something as separate from like the periodic chart of element tables, like they're actually part of the same thing. Like we're all part of this elemental, earthly, like atomized universe stuff.
Yes. 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 And there's like, we are divine, but not to separate, like there, but there, like we are the thing that is deciding the connections. Like we're deciding the connections. It's us.
And Calvin, I'm totally on the same page as you in this regard.
Yeah,
I'm just like, I had an experience taking DMT, the God particle, right? Mm-hmm. And it like seizes you for this 15-minute hallucination. Mm-hmm. And I asked the voice in my head, like, am I talking to God? And it said, yeah. And I was like, that's dumb. I'm talking to myself. And the voice responded and it said, well, what's the difference?
Yeah.
And I was like, oh yeah, that's absolutely what I believe. I just needed to hear it echo around a little bit. Like, oh
yeah,
I am divine. And I love that you're touching on the divinity of the deconstruction in that, I mean, you're both tying that in as something that it has changed you and evolved you into this realized person, right? Like I recognize we're all still walking. We're all still on the path of self-discovery and realization, but when walking in the direction of your truest sense of peace, how could you possibly be more divine than that?
Yeah.
To be within your element.
Yeah.
I really want to talk to you about the creation of your book, Every Good Boy Does Fine. And I would love to start talking about that by perhaps you reading us something and then maybe we could talk about the book. How do you feel about that?
Sure. So let me go get it. So this is a family portrait. A white picket fence in a town called Miriam, where petunias hang heavy above our heads. Cicadas serenade us with summery vespers. Roses lounge around the yard dressed in red. Father fires the cherry grill on Sundays. My cultured children are his delight. Kinky curls bounce off their gilded foreheads, kicking soccer balls left and right. Mother makes her famous potato salad like she's done ever since I was a child. Sparkling water tickles her freckled little nose. She sneezes, then compliments the Italian tile. Fluffy pancakes, pumpkin pancakes, and hot coffee pouring. Our little family is a well-oiled machine. My wife and kids are luminous every single morning. The ancestors would be proud of me. And to think, I gave up this dream to put this dick in your ass.
Yes! Oh. That's my favorite poem.
That was the most satisfying ending one could possibly, like, you're swept up and I'm like, oh, pumpkin pancakes. I like pumpkin pancakes. And then, you know, like, I'm getting lost in this, like, you know, domestic scene. And then all of a sudden you're just like, yep, dick in the ass.
It's such a lead in for the idyllic, right? And people don't recognize, I think, what you end up having to sacrifice and accept the grief of in order to come out, truly, especially if you come out later in life or you came out later because you were in an oppressive system that would not allow you to show your truest face. You've created and conjured all of these ideas that you will be like everyone else, which will make everyone else happy. And then you have to process the grief of that when you realize, like, I cannot live this fully.
Yeah, absolutely.
Such and that's, a powerful and that's piece.
Really what the book is about. And that's the first poem in the book.
Yeah, I wanted to touch on the name really quick. So it's Every Good Boy Does Fine, which is like what you learn, like when you're learning the notes, the lines of like the treble clef, like as a musician. And then it made me think of like the good Christian boy, right?
Yes,
like,
exactly.
So the notion of these two things that like these things that you learned and now things that you're like kind of unlearning or tearing down.
And redefining what fine is.
Right.
And the original concept of the book was going to be more musical based, but then as I was writing it and getting there, I was like, you know, I'm not trying to put this book out there as like a memoir of my musical career. I think that I'm still pretty early on in my musical career, or maybe that I felt like, you know, my music has a life of its own, but the story of deconstruction, the story of being a gay kid in the church, the story, and like really just like sharing the most unflattering some of the most unflattering things or confessions or moments or just like thoughts that I've had, because I want to humanize that struggle and humanize that story and
breaking those parameters, breaking that form, and like it the messiness, right? It's like the energy it takes to like fit yourself into this like ideal Christian good boy, this great musician, right? Like it's very like rigid and like you're following these instructions. It's very like rigid in the indoctrination, right? And it's like redefining like what fine is. Like I can also be fine this way too, and fine is actually not perfection.
Yeah, exactly.
Well, and you touched on that earlier too, with the realm of, you know, feeling like you had to show the plebeians, the Gentiles, that you were living this kind of perfect, idyllic life in order to lure them into this experience with you. And I mean, I the jig was up a little bit earlier for me. I think I was just like, this is all bullshit and I don't want to invite anybody into it. But by nature of kind of accidentally coming out as a teenager, you know, I was not in any way prepared to have a coming out experience to anybody. It just happened. So being kicked out of the church and then dismantling it, like either way, it is, I think, this deep exhalation when it's all settled that you finally get to be the truest version of who you are. And yeah. however you've illustrated that in your book, it's truly powerful and magnificent.
Right. Like if the point is to like lead someone to the light, right? Like you just existing on that street corner or on your pulpit, which is like your stage and your song and your music, you know what I mean? Like I'm drawn to that, you know, like I don't need any kind of like God discourse, right? Like you're doing the work without having to use the framework of that type of language, right?
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely. I think that, you know, our truest, nobody can argue with your story. And so rather than trying to make any kind of arguments or persuasive, you know, instruments of persuasion, just share your truth and people will glean something from your experience, from your perspective. I believe that the truth is the amalgamation of all of the information, of all of the eyes, of all of the things that are living, of all time added up at once. And until a single being can encapsulate all of those experiences at the same time, then none of us have the full truth. We are only as good as many perspectives as we can collect of whatever one subject or whatever. Like we are taking in data and nobody possesses the truth.
Thanks for listening to another episode of Confessing Animals. If you'd like to hear Calvin read some more poems, head over to our Patreon at patreon.com/confessing animals podcast.